This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today, and thank you so much for listening. Today, President Obama announced a shift in U.S. hostage policy that has loomed in the background of the wars in Syria and Iraq, the unrest in Somalia, and the chaos in Yemen. Federal authorities will no longer threaten families of American hostages with criminal prosecution for trying to pay ransom to rescue their loved ones. The government will also be willing to help family members communicate and negotiate with captors. That's a level of support that has not existed prior to this point. Here's President Obama speaking from the White House earlier today.
We are fundamentally changing how our government works with families of hostages. Many of the families told us that they at times felt like an afterthought or a distraction, that too often the law enforcement or military and intelligence officials they were interacting with were begrudging in giving them information.
But for many, including the family of journalist Stephen Sotloff, these changes are coming too late. Sotloff was murdered in September 2014 by the self-proclaimed Islamic State after being held captive for more than a year. And his family shared the same frustration in dealing with the U.S. government that the president just described.
We never really believed that the administration was doing anything to help us. We had meetings with the administration. The family sat with this National Security Council officials, and basically he bullied and hectored them, and they were scared.
That's Sotloff family spokesman Barak Barfi speaking to CBS in September of last year. Our guest is Amanda Lindhout. She's author of A House in the Sky. She's a former journalist who was held hostage in Somalia for 460 days beginning in 2008, before her family was eventually forced to pay $600,000 to her captors and $600,000 to a private security company that facilitated her release.
In 2008, I was a 27-year-old freelance journalist who was based in Baghdad, Iraq, and I went on what I thought was going to be a one-week work trip into Somalia with an Australian colleague of mine, Nigel Brennan, an Australian photographer. On our third day in the country, as we were en route to our big story, an internally displaced people's camp where we were going to go and interview people, our vehicle was ambushed on the side of a road by about a dozen teenage criminals holding AK-47s. What followed was 460 days in captivity inside of Somalia, often very brutal and violent times. We were, Nigel and I, finally released after those 15 and a half months when our families had managed to raise enough money to pay a ransom to our kidnappers who were demanding money for our lives. Of course, both Nigel and I came from Canada and Australia, countries whose governments don't pay ransom. So the onus was really on our families at that time to do it. And at the end of 2009, I was released and came back home here to Canada.
Now, of course, Amanda, you are from Canada, but we should mention that Canada still has the prohibition in place. Canadian citizens aren't allowed to pay ransom or fundraise to pay ransom to terrorist groups. Similar rules to here in the United States that appear to be changing. So the rules in Canada, no paying of ransom and no fundraising, even by private citizens, was that a problem that your parents confronted right away, apart from the difficulty of raising, what was the original ask, $3 million?
It was $3 million that they were asking for, and it was extremely stressful and difficult for my family, who were in the position of doing something that was against the law. They were told by the government of Canada that the payment of ransoms could come with a jail sentence, and so they very quietly, for their daughter's life, my life, held fundraisers without getting media attention, and generous Canadian citizens who felt moved by the story gave. But the Canadian government was watching. And what I would say that the government did in my case was essentially turned a blind eye to my family's efforts, but they certainly made them aware of the laws and what was at stake.
We've had similar situations in the United States where the same thing is illegal, but the State Department or the FBI kind of turns a blind eye. They certainly don't help negotiate ransoms on behalf of the government. In your case, what's amazing is that your mother, as I understand it, was thrust into the role of negotiating with your captor. She's not a professional negotiator, at least I don't think so.
No, she's not. My mother was a cashier at a bakery in Canada, making little more than minimum wage when these criminals called demanding this $1.5 million for my life. So my mother was certainly not a professional negotiator, but she was ultimately thrust into the role of becoming one. She was given some guidance by the Government of Canada, working with police negotiators to train her and coach her how to speak to the main communications guy from the criminal group that had abducted me, whose name was Adam. My mom would be on the phone with Adam sometimes daily, sometimes multiple times in a day, a very erratic and seemingly deranged man who was always demanding money for my life, often threatening my life. And my mother was forced to deal with this sort of terrorizing activity on a daily basis.
Adam, in his negotiating style, if I can call it that, was also very capricious, right? The price would change day to day. There were threats, something that someone who's not a professional negotiator is ill-equipped to handle.
Yeah, my poor mother had to deal with a lot of really terrible phone calls. There was one point in captivity, as anybody who's read the book that I wrote, A House in the Sky, will have known, the 460 days I spent in Somalia were really very violent. And towards the end of my time in captivity, this man who was the negotiator, Adam, was on the phone with my mother and getting very frustrated that the money wasn't being paid. And he said to her, "You think we're playing games with you? We'll show you games." And 6 hours later, a couple of those teenage boys came into the room that I was being held in and tied me up and tortured me for 3 days. So this man, Adam, who was the negotiator, was a really key figure in allowing the things that happened to me to happen inside of Somalia.
And now back in Canada, you've witnessed, at least on TV, one of the negotiators. Is it Adam who was captured and arrested in Canada just last week?
Yeah, last week on June 12th, Adam was arrested in Ottawa, Canada, and is now in jail there awaiting a trial. So this was a very welcome development for my family and I, who have been over the last 5.5 years since my release really trying to process everything that happened. It's definitely a welcome form of justice, and it was nice to see that the Canadian government and the police here in Canada have been working on this over the last 5.5 years, really diligently working towards creating a more positive outcome for me. They were obviously very limited in what they could do to support myself and my family while I was in captivity, but there was quite a bit they could do on the other side, and to see that they've actually done it and gone through with an arrest is really gratifying for me.
And so it really appears that the U.S. government probably has been influenced to some extent by your terrible experience. The government is not going to start saying that paying ransoms is okay, and certainly the State Department here in the U.S. isn't going to start paying them. I guess we all get that. What does it mean, though, for families to now not have the threat of prosecution, to have some of these rules being changed if they're thrust into the terrible role of trying to negotiate themselves or with a security company, I suppose, for the release of a loved one?
I think this is such an important development. For example, I have been in touch over the last year and a half with Jim Foley's mother, who was herself threatened by the U.S. government as she was trying to raise money and negotiate ransom payment for Jim Foley before his death. And these kind of developments are really going to be critical, I think, because families like my family, like Jim Foley's family, are often in the position of needing to raise the money, needing to negotiate with these people for a family member's life. And when you have the extra burden and stress of having the government say, if you do this, there's a jail sentence. I mean, try telling that to any mother whose daughter is in captivity across the world. It's just not going to happen.
It'll make a big difference for families. And yet you sort of mentioned in your own experience kind of a dual experience with your own government, at least on behalf of your family. One, a threat of prosecution and a blind eye. On the other, in the end, some help with learning how to negotiate, learning what to do. So there seems to be a lot of dissonance in Canada really still about how to handle this. Do your American counterparts complain about the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that when you become kidnapped, you become part of this funny little club. And so I am connected to families and survivors of kidnappings all over the world. And certainly those that I know in the United States, every one of the families that I have been in touch with has expressed how difficult it was to work with the government. So I think that this change is really going to be a positive development. And I am very much hoping that the Canadian government takes heed and follows suit.
The Obama administration announcing today that families of hostages held overseas will no longer be threatened with prosecution if they privately negotiate to pay ransom for the release of those hostages. Amanda Lindhout is author of A House in the Sky. She's a former journalist who herself was held hostage in Somalia for 460 days in 2008. Her family negotiated successfully, ultimately, for her release. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Todd.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.